Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, a big news wrap-up, piling on Chairman Martin, intellectual property, and NPR is still hating on low-power FM. You do want to stay tuned. The House Energy and Commerce Committee might be turning up the heat on FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. Staff members are recommending that the committee hold public hearings in June on Martin's management practices. In a memo to committee chairman John Dingell and Representative Bart Stupak, who chairs the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, the staff write, quote, "The bottom line is that the FCC process appears broken, and most of the blame appears to rest with Chairman Martin," end quote. One of the major complaints lodged against Martin is that he has been excessively secretive, keeping even his fellow commissioners in the dark about proposed decisions and meeting agendas until the very last moment. The most infamous example of this tactic happened last December when Martin revealed his plan to do away with the newspaper TV cross-ownership ban in an op-ed published in the New York Times before he had even revealed his intentions to the other four commissioners. In their memo, the House Energy and Commerce Committee staff said that their investigation into Martin's management is ongoing, and they said that their recommendation for a public hearing is based on, quote, "more than 30 interviews with current and former FCC employees, as well as industry representatives and private citizens," end quote. Speaking of the FCC's near total revocation of the cross-ownership ban, on April 24th, the Senate Commerce Committee unanimously approved a joint resolution disapproving the commission's December party-line vote on that issue. Committee Chairman Daniel Inouye said, quote, "It is clear to me that the commission rushed its process. The agency rolled back its rules, preventing media concentration despite getting a cautionary light from the Congress that more public comment and more attention to localism and minority ownership was needed before barreling ahead," end quote. A similar resolution is being floated in the House. The resolution has a total of 25 co-sponsors in the full Senate, including both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Senator Obama urged swift passage of the bill, although its prospects of making it past President Bush look slim. At the same time, it looks like Martin is wasting no time in trying to polish his public image. He held a press conference on April 24th where he announced that topics for open meeting agendas will now be made public on the FCC website at least 3 weeks prior to each monthly meeting. Until now, the practice had been to issue a public notice of the agenda 1 week ahead. At the same press conference, Martin then announced the agenda for the upcoming May 14th meeting. Noticeably absent from the agenda was any consideration of the proposed XM Sirius satellite radio merger, which has already been approved by the Justice Department. That means a decision isn't likely to happen until late May or June, keeping XM and Sirius execs, as well as some investors, sweating it out, waiting by the phone. Amateur radio enthusiasts won a victory over the Federal Communications Commission's plan to encourage deployment of a so-called third pipe in the form of broadband internet over power lines, also known as BPL. The American Radio Relay League, which represents the interests of ham radio operators, sued the FCC, contending that the commission's plans are insufficient to protect against interference with amateur radio, in addition to being inconsistent with existing rules. On April 25th, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling questioning the FCC's BPL rulemaking process, sending the rule back to the FCC to do over. The court was critical of the commission redacting portions of five scientific studies that the FCC commissioned in order to measure BPL's interference risks. The court also said that the FCC had provided no reasoned explanation for why it rejected data submitted by the ARRL that might otherwise have influenced its rulemaking. Although finding fault with the FCC's rulemaking process, the court did not agree with the ARRL's contention that the FCC should require BPL operators to shut down immediately if found to be causing harmful interference. The court said that the FCC had adequately explained that there isn't sufficient evidence that harmful interference is an imminent threat. There are approximately 35 broadband over power line systems in the U.S. with about 5,000 subscribers. The FCC will now have to take another look at this issue, taking into account more critical information provided by the amateur radio community. April 28th was the deadline to file comments in the FCC's proposed rules aimed at promoting localism in broadcasting. Many of these rules are unpopular with broadcasters because they call for having staff present during all hours of operation, more record keeping, and the establishment of local advisory boards. A coalition of medium-sized broadcast groups filed joint comments calling the proposed rules, quote, blunt and burdensome, unquote, while the National Association of Broadcasters claimed the rules would have the opposite effect, making broadcasters less able to serve the public interest. Joining the chorus of dissent are 23 senators and Republican FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell. Religious radio networks like K-Love and the Calvary Chapel Satellite Network urged their listeners to file comments opposing the proposed rules, and hundreds complied. The opposition primarily focused on the requirement to have stations staffed, since most of these stations are satellite-fed for a good portion of their broadcast day, and therefore they're mostly automated. At least one community radio broadcaster also filed comments opposing the staffing requirements as burdensome. On the other side of the spectrum are public interest groups, which filed comments in support of the proposed rules and then suggested some additional ones. Joint comments were filed by the Public Interest Public Airwaves Coalition, Center for Creative Voices and Media, Free Press, and the National Hispanic Media Coalition. They asked the FCC to require broadcasters that want expedited license renewals to set aside 1% of their airtime for unpaid public service announcements, to have no more than 30% of their airtime be infomercials or home shopping, and to air a, quote, reasonable amount, end quote, of independently produced programming. Moreover, they asked the commission to reduce broadcast license terms from 8 to 3 years, and to commit to acting on any petition to deny renewals within 180 days. The FCC is now accepting reply comments addressing the issues raised in the first round of comments. You can learn more about the localism proceeding and file comments to the FCC at their website at www.fcc.gov/localism, or go to the MediaGeek website at mediageek.net. And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I'm your host. And today is quite a bit of the critical examination of our media environment, doing a big news wrap-up on issues I think are important to anyone who's concerned about our ability to communicate freely, to receive good information, and to share good information, whether it's on the airways or on the internet, or through other means. This is important to our ability to function in a democracy. Media Geeks Online at MediaGeek.net. The radio show, of course, is at radio.mediageek.net. You can listen in your browser. You can download the program, or you can subscribe to the podcast to get it automatically downloaded to your MP3 player or your computer. Just go to MediaGeek.net. And if you got any comments, I do like to hear them. I don't get much feedback, but every bit of feedback is valuable. Send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And if you want to keep up with me in a slightly less formal manner, I am Twittering at Twitter. You can see my tweets, the posts to Twitter. They're at mediageek.net, or you can go to twitter.com and look for Media Geek. So now we're going to cover some news of importance to intellectual property. And this is something I have covered over the years on Media Geek. And intellectual property is important, I think, because it really does not only deal with our consumption of culture, but our ability to use and participate in culture. You know, they say that most there are very few original ideas in art, and that there is a level of copying. There's a little bit of a degree of derivative works. If you look at the most famous Disney movies, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Cinderella, they're based on fairy tales. No royalties were paid by Walt Disney and his company to the original authors of these fairy tales. They're simply works of culture that were in the in use, and everyone knew, and he was able to readapt them for his movies. And there's an element to which we should all be able to readapt cultural works, to readapt the folk stories of our times, and to use them. But it also, you know, covers all these other things that people don't think about, like documentary work, the ability to do news gathering, and how the control of copyright can interfere with actually our ability to know and propagate information that is very important to us. So not merely just art, not that art is mere, but also for information that can be very important for a functioning in a political society. So let's say that you're working on a documentary about an historical subject, say the underground press of the 1960s, and you find some archival footage along with photos and other images that you'd like to use. But you can't track down the original authors or publishers, the people who own the copyright. Under current law, you can't use these materials in your film without risking legal liability if the copyright owner should surface and then object to your using them without permission. These sorts of materials, where the original copyright holder can't be identified or located, are known as orphan works. Now, two bills have been entered into Congress, in the House and Senate, to try and address orphan works by specifying provisions for finding copyright owners and also by specifying terms for using orphan works when legitimate efforts have been made to find the copyright holder. Senate Bill 2913, the Sean Bentley Orphan Works Act of 2008, and House Resolution 5889, the Orphan Works Acts of 2008, are both based on recommendations made by the Copyright Office. These bills would allow someone to use a copyrighted work without permission only after conducting a so-called diligent effort into a specified qualifying search. The Copyright Office would maintain and make available search guidelines. In turn, if someone who used an orphan work is later challenged, a court would consider whether or not these best practices were followed. One of the problems that arises when trying to track down the copyright holder of visual works, like paintings or photographs, is that the Copyright Office's registry is text-based, making it difficult to find a copyright registration unless you know the registered name of the work or the copyright holder. If passed, these bills would require the Copyright Office to certify private registry services for visual works, and a number of these already exist. If a copyright owner does indeed come forward to claim rights on a work thought to be orphaned, the bills then provide for the owner to be reasonably compensated by the author who used their work. Under current law, however, that user would be subject to punitive civil and criminal penalties in addition to simple remuneration. But under these bills, if it turns out that the user did not make diligent effort to find the copyright holder, then that user will be subject to the penalties associated with copyright infringement. Although a lot of consideration was given to protect copyright owners from users who might try to use these bills to cover up what is essentially infringing use, many visual artists, like photographers and illustrators, are still concerned. They worry that the costs and overhead associated with making sure they are findable, such as registering their works at a private registry, will be onerous nevertheless. Defenders of orphan works legislation countered that copyright holders do not lose their rights and can still be compensated even if they do not register. The function of registries is to make them easier to find and therefore more easily able to obtain royalties should they be willing to license their works. If they don't register with a registry, it doesn't mean that they don't have this right. The Internet Archive, the Association of Public Television Stations, the Association of Research Libraries and the public interest group Public Knowledge joined together to support the orphan works legislation, noting that they would bring balance to copyright law if passed. Now the bills need to be taken up by the Senate Judiciary Committee and the House Intellectual Property Subcommittee. To learn more, go to publicknowledge.org. On April 30th, the House Judiciary Committee took a step to crack down further on piracy and counterfeiting by stiffening penalties and enforcement. It passed the Prioritizing Resources and Organizational for Intellectual Property Act, also known as the Pro-IP Act. Boy, they go a long way to create an acronym. The chief sponsor of that bill is the chairman of that committee, John Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan. Missing from this recently revised bill is a measure that would have dramatically increased fines for copyright infringement, but still in the bill is a measure allowing federal officials to seize property from convicted copyright infringers who made unauthorized copies of music, movies, or live performances. However, some consideration has been given to the risk that an innocent person's property might be seized, such as if a person's Wi-Fi network were used by a convicted infringer without the owner's notice. The bill was amended to make clear that there must be a, quote, substantial connection, end quote, between the property seized and the violation in question. However, it remains unclear just how shielded Jane Q. Public would be from having her computers confiscated if a convicted pirate used her Wi-Fi access point to distribute his wares. The legislation would also create a new executive appointed position called the U.S. Intellectual Property Enforcement Representative, modeled on the U.S. Trade Representative. Nevertheless, the bill is still pretty unpopular in a lot of circles, especially in tech. Surprisingly, it isn't popular with the Justice Department, which believes that establishing the IP Enforcement Representative would undermine its independence. The original unamended pro-IP bill was called, quote, the most outrageously gluttonous IP bill ever introduced in the U.S., end quote, by William Patry, former law professor, copyright counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives, author of a new 7-volume treatise on copyright, and the current senior copyright counsel to Google. In a blog post dated December 10, 2007, Patry wrote, quote, the question is not whether copyright is a good thing. Properly calibrated copyright is very good, indeed essential for certain classes of works. But an excessive amount of something that is beneficial in measured doses can become fatal in overdoses, and copyright is already at fatal strength, end quote. He goes on to say, quote, the idea that criminal forfeiture provisions drafted to reach major drug traffickers like the Colombian cartels should be inserted into civil copyright tort provisions with a preponderance of the evidence burden is mind-blowing. The capacity, if not intent, of these provisions for profound mischievousness is obvious. In addition to the gluttonous statutory damages that would be available, content owners now want defendants to forfeit their computers, their cars, and their homes. All of these can be said to have been used in the commission of infringement, end quote. And as a side note, getting the House to move on the pro-IP bill didn't come cheap. The Recording Industry Association of America spent $2 million in 2007 lobbying Congress for tougher intellectual property laws, just like the Pro-IP bill. Just how many CDs or iTunes purchases does that add up to? Do you have an opinion on the Pro-IP bill? Well, communicate it to your House representative. One phone call can mean a lot. Well, now stepping away from intellectual property and moving to the world of non-commercial broadcasting, I want to make mention of an article recently published by Matthew Lazar at the website Ars Technica. And Matthew is a professor of history, and he's written a definitive history of the Pacifica Network, which is the original community radio network, sprung forth from KPFA, really the first community radio station in Berkeley, California, which set the precedent for non-commercial broadcasting in a lot of ways as we know it. Matthew keeps a great website called the Lazar Letter on the FCC at www.llfcc.org. And he's noted that National Public Radio, as he says, continues to move aggressively against Federal Communications Commission proposals that would, if not allow nonprofits to build more low-power FM stations, at least let existing ones survive the intrusion of new full-power neighbors. Now, this is a story I've been covering on MediaGeek back to the beginning of the program back in 2002 and its previous incarnation as a show called Radio Free Conscience, which only aired on community radio WEFT, but there are some archives online. Which is the fact that National Public Radio opposed and has continued to oppose low-power FM since it was first proposed by the FCC back in 2000. And the main reason why NPR has opposed low-power FM, the main reason they say they do, is because they're worried about interference, which is the same flag flown by the National Association of Broadcasters. NPR has a slightly different take on it, mostly due to the fact that many of their affiliate stations rely rather heavily on translator stations, repeater stations, something we've mentioned and talked quite a bit about here on Media Geek over the years as well, to repeat the signal of higher power stations. This is especially true out west, where you both have very fairly desolate areas and very mountainous and hilly areas where FM stations don't propagate so much. Indeed, I got to pose a question about this to Kevin Close, president of NPR himself, when he made an appearance at Urbana, Illinois, back in 2001. Again, something which I blogged about there on the Media Geek website, in which he did a poor job of defending, although he did buttonhole me after I posed the question to him in a public forum to tell me how much he was in support of the basic idea of low-power FM, but how NPR had to listen to its Western affiliates who were very worried about interference. Well, they're still hanging their hat on that interference question. And the thing that the FCC has proposed right now is to really give low-power FM stations better status on the dial. Right now, they're considered secondary services. So that means if you have a new station broadcasting at 100 watts in your town with lots of community voices, and a full-power station in a nearby community would like to move to a frequency or move its location such that it might interfere with your local community station, your low-power station, it has the right to do so. The low-power station must absorb whatever interference happens from that, even if when they put the station on the air, it seemed like a clear frequency. Now, a full power station, a non-low power FM station, has actually rights to its frequencies, does not have to absorb any interference, and has the right to defend itself. The FCC would like to extend this right to low power FM stations. Furthermore, recognizing that low-power FM stations are specifically designed to be used by community organizations, by nonprofits, by church groups, by schools, by organizations that are sort of by definition not well-heeled, it wants to place the burden on the full-power stations if they want to move their geographic location to alert low-power FM stations of this happening and to work with the low-power FM stations to minimize interference, to keep the low-power FM stations on the air, to basically say there ought to be a good neighbor policy, and if a full-power station wants to move, they ought to take into consideration the low-power FM station's propagation. NPR continues to oppose this, and Matthew Lazar's written a great article, as I mentioned. You can get a reference to it at the Media Geek website. But he quotes NPR's filing with the FCC, in which it writes, quote, "The laws of physics have not changed, and a system of full-power broadcast stations serves many more listeners with less interference compared to low-power broadcasting. While LPFM stations may advance the interests of localism and diversity, the commission cannot assume that LPFM is inherently better than full power service, end quote. And this is a line which NPR has written not just since 2000, but going back all the way into the 1970s, because indeed low power radio existed from virtually the very beginning of the FM dial in the 1940s. 10-watt stations, 100-watt stations were licensed to schools and community organizations for the purpose of training broadcasters and providing community-level service. And that was done away with in 1978. And it was done away with at the behest of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio, which filed a petition with the FCC, a proposal for rulemaking, back in the early 70s, finally acted on in 1978. And in fact, I wrote a book chapter with that history if you're interested in looking it up. It's in a book called The Radio Reader, which is edited by Michelle Helms and Jason Laviglio. And I believe it's still in print and you can still find it. And indeed, it was this argument that full power stations, that 1,000 watt and higher stations, serve the public better in public service than low power stations could, whether they are a college station, a high school station, or a community station. And it's amazing to me to see that this very same line, this very same rationale is still being trotted out here in 2008, nearly 30 years later, when we've seen the pendulum swing from doing away with low power stations to coming back to the recognition that in that process, in the intervening 22 years since low power radio was first done away with, you saw the clear channels, you saw the consolidation of radio dial, and the virtual death of localism. And Matthew Lazar notes that, you know, indeed, NPR coming out against the protection of low power FM stations is a serious issue. He says, because over the last decade, NPR service has expanded from 635 to 800 affiliated stations. And public radio stance in this puts it at odds with practically every media reform group in the country. And it puts a lot of us, I think, a lot of people who are in who consider themselves on the side of media reform and the side of public interest in a funny place, since we probably listen to public radio and have supported public radio in various forms, because a lot of good service, often local service, but not always, is provided. A lot of good programs are on public radio. And here we have NPR still in 2008 lobbying against low-power community radio, sort of accepting the fact that it exists, but saying it should not be protected. And as I argued in my book chapter, which I just mentioned before in the Radio Reader, I still believe that this is because it's not merely a matter of the so-called technical issues, which have been put to sleep. The MITRE report, which was commissioned or required by Congress, commissioned by the FCC, by an engineering group, which is a big Washington insider, not, you know, crusading and not at all outside, said that low-power FM stations, even when moved closer on the dial to other stations, full power stations, don't cause interference. NPR is still hanging on an interference issue, which has been shown to be a red herring time and again. This brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views in our media environment. In the meantime, check out the Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. You can listen to and download the program at radio.mediageek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. If you have any comments about the program, I'd love to read them. Send them to paul@mediageek.net. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and also is heard on 12 other community stations across North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KWMD in Kosilof in Anchorage, Alaska, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, CHMA in Sackville, New Brunswick, WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. The Media Geek Radio Show is available for free to any non-commercial community station. Just send email to paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.